From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we revisit the creation of the Patriot Act, a blitzkrieg maneuver that set the stage for 14 years of legal and political wrangling. We took on the Patriot Act 6 months ago on the eve of the expiration of several key provisions. The future was full of uncertainty and promise because we seemed to be teetering on the brink of a post-Patriot Act era. No, that's too strong. Let's just say a somewhat less Patriot Act-y era.
Long story short, the provisions expired, then were partially reinstated. And now, well, more on that later. But 6 months after the original legislative showdown, in the midst of a furious campaign season, and after the Paris attacks, the fundamental struggle between security and civil liberties has gained new urgency. But let's begin at the beginning, a tortured acronym that kinda said it all, uniting and strengthening America by providing appropriate tools required to intercept and obstruct terrorism. Put it all together and you get the USA Patriot Act.
Born in smoke, ashes, and fear.
Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane. So this looks like it is some sort of a concerted effort to attack the World Trade Center that is underway.
You know all that. You don't need a lengthy audio montage to remember September 11th, 2001. So here's a montage you haven't heard from the floor of the House of Representatives on October 12th, 2001.
Mr. Speaker, we had a bipartisan bill, and John Ashcroft destroyed it. The Attorney General has fired the first partisan shot since September 11th.
And today we are asked to buy a pig in a poke, a 187-page bill, hot off the presses, that we haven't had a chance to read or analyze.
And I find it to have been done in a sneaky, dishonest fashion. It reflects very poorly on this body.
Virtually no one in this chamber, outside of perhaps a few people on the committee, have any idea what's in that bill. Why should we care? Well, it's only the Constitution. It's only individual liberty at stake.
We'll return to that House vote on October 12th. But first,
today, America has experienced one of the greatest tragedies ever witnessed on our soil.
Nobody took issue with Attorney General John Ashcroft on that awful afternoon. But his next sentence,
they're an assault on the security and the freedom of every American citizen.
In English class, they call that foreshadowing. At the time, he wasn't talking about American countermeasures, but later, many would come to read it that way. Here's Ashcroft a few days after the attacks.
We need additional tools. As a matter of fact, we'll be going to the Hill sometime in the next few days with a variety of upgrades and strengthening provisions in our statutes to help us do some things to curtail the assault of terrorism, which we are fighting.
On Capitol Hill that October, with new barricades erected in front of federal buildings, anxiety crossed party lines. That included the liberal chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy, who had been at the Supreme Court on 9/11, monitoring news from Lower Manhattan.
We heard a bump. We could actually see smoke across the river. That was when the Pentagon got hit. At that point, we had no idea how many other attacks there might be. And we sat there and waited.
You're a longtime staunch defender of civil liberties, but 14 years ago, like everyone else, you were highly motivated to prevent further attacks. And negotiations with congressional Republicans in the White House went pretty well, at least at first, did they not?
Well, they did. We actually worked out a general framework that we had agreed on, and with John Ashcroft. And then the next thing I knew, he called a press conference, described something entirely different, and we got to do it immediately or we're in grave danger. I said, John, that's entirely different than what you agreed on yesterday. He said, well, I've changed my mind, and if people are going to stand up for America, they'll go along with me. The fact they said, just pass it and we'll tell you what to put in it afterward. It's almost that bad. Fortunately, enough of us, Republicans and Democrats, said, we kind of like to see what we're voting on.
Mr. Bennett, Mr. Biden,
Mr. Bingaman.
On October 11th, the Senate voted on a version of the bill very much to Ashcroft's liking, passing it 96-1. But Leahy and the House leadership wouldn't give way entirely on the need to set time limits on the new powers they'd endowed on the White House.
We agree that there were so many new tools given to the government that we'd better put a sunset provision in it so that future Congresses would be forced to look at it, not in the stress of the moment, but after a few years of actually seeing how it works.
On October 17th, with Capitol Hill half shut down by anthrax attacks, a small group of leaders of both houses met to reconcile House and Senate versions of the bill, only to have a Bush administration envoy demand the sunset provisions be removed. Leahy says that Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert told the man to shut up or get out. The White House acquiesced, but also had the last laugh by interpreting the law pretty much the way it wanted to, regardless of the Congress's intent.
Both Republicans and Democrats never expected them to go so far beyond what we'd written in the law.
That possibility was either written right there in the legislation or sort of conspicuously not written there. And yet, all but one Democrat, including you, voted for the Patriot Act. That one Senate Democrat was Russ Feingold, former senator from Wisconsin.
Yep.
As you look back on it, in voting no, was he right?
In many ways, he perhaps was.
By the way, the full Senate Judiciary Committee never got a crack at that bill. It was negotiated by the leadership with Justice Department and White House staff behind closed doors. When it came time to vote, Majority Leader Democrat Tom Daschle discouraged amendments. A few were offered, notably by Russ Feingold. None passed.
I think it's important to remember that the Constitution was written in 1789 by men who had recently won the Revolutionary War.
Russ Feingold.
They didn't live in comfortable and easy times of hypothetical enemies. They wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect individual liberties in times of war as well as times of peace.
Now on to the House vote the following day. There, the entire Judiciary Committee under the leadership of Republican Chairman James Sensenbrenner had done painstaking work, emerging with many hard-won concessions and a unanimously supported bill. All for nothing.
Mr. Speaker, I have never seen the legislative process more degraded than it is by this process.
Massachusetts Democrat Barney Frank was outraged. The bill hammered out by the Judiciary Committee was not the one being offered for a vote on the floor.
And we have today an outrageous procedure. A bill drafted by a handful of people in secret, subjected to no committee process, comes before us immune from amendment.
This is still warm. It just came off the Xerox machine. There could be problems. I don't know.
Democrats like Peter DeFazio of Oregon were in an uproar.
I just asked a member of the Judiciary Committee who voted for the bill in committee. What's in the bill? He said, who could know what's in this? It was just handed to him. And we're going to be required to vote on it in the next few hours. Why? Will these laws go into effect this weekend and make a difference in protecting people and making them more safe? No.
This new substitute bill was a black box. In fact, there may have been only one copy. They knew only the rough outlines, none of the details.
What we have before us is a tale of two bills.
New York Democrat Louise Slaughter.
One bill was crafted by the Standing Committee of the House. The other was crafted by the Attorney General and the President. One bill is limited in scope and sunsets after this crisis will have passed. The other bill is a power grab by prosecutors that can be used not just in terrorism cases, but in drug cases and gun cases.
It was not the bill that was negotiated in the House.
Republican James Sensenbrenner, then chairman of the House Judiciary Committee.
The administration did not like the civil liberties protection that resulted in the unanimous vote. And as a result, they went to the Senate Democrats, specifically Senator Daschle, to water down some of those civil liberties protection. The deal that was made was that the sunset would stay in despite vigorous objections from the administration. President Bush on down. And that was what was passed and signed into law.
This new bill reportedly had been pushed through by House Speaker Dennis Hastert under pressure from the White House.
If we were to pass anything in this area, it had to be signed off by Dennis Hastert and approved by the Rules Committee. And it was.
Congressman, did you actually have any choice in this matter?
No.
And as in the Senate, there would be an up or down vote. No amendments. Barney Frank.
So all of that thoughtful process, all of the compromise, all of the anguishing decisions we had to make about how do you balance self-defense with protections against abuse, that's all to be compressed into a 5-minute partisan motion. Shame on the people who have brought this forward.
It passed by a vote of 337-79. As for the final bill, a handful of House and Senate leaders negotiated behind closed doors and issued no report. James Sensenbrenner.
A law had to be passed. You know, I am not one that will let the perfect defeat the good. The Patriot Act, on balance, was good.
Hello, NSA. Been feeling lonely in the world today. I got some things been on my mind.
Coming up, remind me again, what's in the Patriot Act?
And as goes Washington, so goes France. This is On the Media.
This Patriot Act's been so much fun. Oh, people say ball up in the business.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So in the end, the birth of the Patriot Act becomes an emergency surgery. The doctors fraught, scrambling, and sliding on a floor slick with broken promises.
But now that we've discussed the birth, how about a quick sketch of the baby? It was designed to deliver us from evil doers. The administration told us, hurry, not a moment to lose. But the solutions it sought were oddly unproductive.
People don't have the time to think of solutions to what actually happens. And so what they do is they pull off the shelf things that they've been trying to get done for the last 10 years or more.
Morton Halperin served as a national security official in the Johnson, Nixon, where he was spied on, and Clinton administrations, and as a senior advisor to the Open Society Foundations. He says that a key aspect to understanding the Patriot Act is realizing that it actually had very little to do with the events of 9/11.
Everything in the Patriot Act, you will find, was proposed to the Congress by one of the past administrations, and the Congress failed to do it because they understood that it went too far and violated people's liberties.
Like what, for example? Well, expanding wiretap capabilities, allowing the use of secret evidence in prosecutions, and the potential for indefinite detention of non-U.S. citizens, all included in the Patriot Act, but first proposed in 1995 in a bill called the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act, sponsored by then-Senator Joe Biden. That bill failed, but as the Patriot Act was being debated in 2001, Senator Biden proudly told a New Republic reporter, quote, "The bill John Ashcroft sent up was my bill."
Another crucial element. The Patriot Act allows for the greater sharing of intelligence between departments. When conducting foreign intelligence to track terrorists, you don't need to find probable cause for a warrant to invade a suspect's privacy, to search and to seize. But when tracking criminal suspects, you do need those things.
And therefore, there was no incentive to cheat, because if you found some incriminating evidence, you couldn't use it in a criminal prosecution.
That's Virginia Democrat Bobby Scott, who voted against the Patriot Act, partly because it suddenly offered an incentive to cheat. Law enforcement, working in an interagency task force with, say, the CIA, might ask a favor.
You could say, look, I think we got a suspect over here. I don't have probable cause to listen in, but you can use intelligence gathering. And if you see something, bring it to me.
But if you were going to charge somebody, would you be permitted to give this kind of intelligence in court?
It's admissible, because once you've got it, you could share it. And you can run your criminal investigation without the normal civil liberties protections. And you have an incentive to do it.
The act also includes Section 213, which allows federal agents to secretly enter a home or office, even seize materials. They're called sneak and peek searches, and the government can now take up to 30 days to inform the inhabitant that they were there. The Justice Department claims such searches are crucial for investigating without tipping off terrorists.
But the Electronic Frontier Foundation reported in 2014 that of over 11,000 sneak and peek requests, only 51 were used for terrorism. Speaking of which, there's also Section 411, which expands the official definition of terrorism, and Section 806, which allows the government to seize the assets of any individual or organization engaged in or planning to commit an act of domestic or international terrorism, to be determined, of course, by the government.
And then there are those provisions that have been used to extend wiretapping, spying, and the collection of personal information, namely Sections 214, 216, 505, 206, and 215, the latter two of which are set to expire this weekend.
Thus concludes our quick trip through the Patriot Act. Although, as you know, there's quite a gap between what it says and how it's used. But more on that later. Now we bring you some news.
We first examined the Patriot Act during a struggle over its most infamous provisions that expired at the end of May. Provisions that allowed for the bulk collection of Americans' digital data. At the time, Congress was divided among those who sought to extend that power indefinitely, those seeking to kill it once and for all, and those who wanted a compromise.
Weirdly, compromise won out in the form of the Freedom Act, which aimed to do away with the most egregious elements of the program without ending it entirely, including striking Section 215, which authorized phone metadata collection and which had been declared illegal. One of the Freedom Act's proponents was Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who we spoke to at the time.
Of course, it is a dangerous world. If you've been on the Intelligence Committee, you know that. But that's not a reason for reauthorizing a program that does not make America safer and impinges on our privacy. And so what I've been telling my colleagues is we ought to recognize that the status quo caucus, really the leadership of the Senate Republicans, they're just expecting people to blink. And I'm not going to blink in the face of a flawed, misguided law that does not make us safer and compromises our liberties.
The Freedom Act struck down Section 215 and gave the NSA 6 months to wind down its data collection before handing that task over to the telecoms. That 6 months ends this weekend. For civil libertarians, it was a moment for cautious optimism, a sign that Americans who had readily signed away their freedoms in those feverish days after 9/11 might be ready to reclaim them. But that was 6 months ago. And as Senator Wyden said, the world is a dangerous place.
A truth reinforced by the recent attacks in Paris, and in their wake, a familiar refrain.
Should the government be allowed to tap into your apps? The latest attacks spark a debate over national security and your privacy.
Former NSA deputy director, he spoke about encryption, he spoke about terrorism, and how it just makes it harder and harder to track terrorists.
CIA director John Brennan stood up yesterday and he said, a lot of the things that we've done to protect civil liberties has made us less safe.
A mood reflected by such politicians as Jeb Bush after the Paris attacks.
I will fight to restore the Patriot Act's metadata program to ensure we have the ability to connect the dots between known foreign terrorists and the potential operatives here in the United States of America.
Bush is one of many. Freshman Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton proposed a bill that would push back the implementation of the Freedom Act from this weekend to January 2017. At the earliest. Cotton, like Bush, relies on that perennial security argument that mass data collection is essential in order for us to fight terrorism, and if we'd only had more data, we might have prevented the atrocities we've already suffered.
But Elizabeth Goitein, co-director of the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program, says that not only is their premise flimsy, all the evidence is on the other side.
The automatic response, I think, to a terrorist attack is, well, we need more information. We should be collecting more information no matter what that information is. But this particular program was a program to collect the telephone records of Americans So having those records would have done absolutely nothing to prevent the attacks in Paris. And in fact, that information did nothing to prevent any terrorist attacks during the 15 years that that program was in effect. There had been independent reviews conducted of that program, one by a commission that President Obama established, one by something called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. These groups had full access to all of the classified information, and they concluded that the bulk collection of Americans' telephone records had little or no counterterrorism benefit.
And yet, presidential candidate Marco Rubio has backed Cotton's bill, saying that it, quote, will provide the intelligence community one more essential tool to help law enforcement connect the dots of terror communications, uncover threats against the U.S. and our allies, and help keep terrorists out of the U.S. Are you saying he's just wrong?
He is wrong. We know for a fact that this program is not an essential tool that they know full well would have done nothing to prevent the Paris attacks. What's happened is that intelligence and law enforcement agencies have become addicted to data. And there's a sense that if only they could collect it all, then we'd have perfect security. But we know that that doesn't work. If you look at the underwear bomber, the Fort Hood shooting, the Boston Marathon bombing, the Paris attacks, in all of these cases, the intelligence agencies had the information. They just failed to act on it. And at least in some of those cases, it's partly because the agencies had too much data. Intelligence agencies are drowning in data, and the real threats here are getting lost in the noise.
Hmm. I'm sure you haven't missed the fact that the attacks in Paris also fanned the flames of the encryption debate. Now intelligence officials have argued even more vociferously for the idea that tech companies like Apple and Google should enable law enforcement to decode their customers' encrypted messages by building backdoors into their devices.
This is something that law enforcement officials have been trying to get for decades, and there's two reasons why it's never happened. First, the United States can't tell foreign companies what to do. So if we decide to mandate backdoors for Apple and Microsoft, the terrorists will just switch over to services that fall outside of our jurisdiction, or they'll create their own. Al-Qaeda built its own encryption software, and they're not going to build a backdoor for the NSA. So there's no way that backdoors can prevent serious terrorist attacks. The second problem is that backdoors will actually make the rest of us less secure. The technology experts have all weighed in. There is no way to build a backdoor that only the U.S. government can walk through. So as soon as you create that vulnerability in the system, you open all of us up to hackers, to identity thieves, to the Chinese government, companies engaged in economic espionage, cyber terrorists, you name it. There is such widespread consensus among the experts that backdoors would be a net loss for security, and that's even putting aside the privacy interests.
How widespread is this consensus?
Among technology experts, it's pretty much universal. If we're talking about national security officials or law enforcement officials, those who are in office now are probably, I would say, divided. Those who are out of office and can speak more frankly tend to support strong encryption.
If this consensus is so strong that it's just going to make things worse for people who operate legally and will have no impact on the people we're trying to track, why does it keep coming up? It kind of feels a little like climate change.
That's a very interesting analogy. It's natural, I think, for law enforcement officials to prefer fewer encumbrances on what they do. And this is an encumbrance, and so they don't like it.
It also has something to do with the way the intelligence community has been operating. Data collection, at least since 9/11, seems to be the main thing that the intelligence community does. I mean, we keep hearing about the lack of human intelligence, but we've got data up to our eyebrows.
And that's really part of the problem. It's not just a habit, it's an ethos. When you are a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so the imperative is to collect more, collect more, collect more. And we need to stand back. We need to take an objective look at whether there might be a better, leaner and meaner approach to intelligence where the collection is more targeted at the threats we actually face and where there's more attention paid to analysis of the information that we receive rather than just trying to sweep it all in.
So, it is now Sunday, let us say, November 29th. Barring Cotton's bill or something else, what is happening?
the USA Freedom Act takes effect. What that means is that if the government wants to obtain Americans' phone records or any other type of business records using these foreign intelligence collection authorities, it has to tie its request to a specific selection term. So that's something like a person's phone number or a person's email address, a person's account. It doesn't have to be as narrow as a single person. For example, the government could use an IP address, and an IP address can potentially encompass hundreds of people. But it has to be a lot narrower than the collect it all program that was in effect previously.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Goitein co-directs the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program.
In the aftermath of the attack on the French satirical paper Charlie Hebdo in January, France's government put forth a series of proposals dramatically extending its surveillance powers. It was referred to at the time as the French Patriot Act.
Today, France's parliament has passed its own intelligence act.
It's been dubbed the French Patriot Act.
That bill passed and went into effect. But in May, while the bill's future was uncertain, I spoke with Clémence Bechtart, a Paris-based lawyer for the International Federation for Human Rights, who was concerned about the potential consequences and disappointed by the degree of popular support.
It's true that we would have more expected such piece of legislation coming out from the Sarkozy administration than from the Hollande administration. But on these considerations, there seems to be a political unanimity in France saying that security is more important than the respect of individual liberties and freedoms.
Now that unanimity is once again rearing its head. After the terrorist attacks in Paris 2 weeks ago, French President François Hollande declared an immediate state of emergency, which the French Parliament quickly extended for 3 months, drawing comparisons yet again to the Patriot Act. Clémence Bechtart rejoins us. Clémence, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you. Hello.
Tell me what state of emergency means.
Well, it enables the French executive power to have very extended powers without the control of a judge, arrests, house searches. François Hollande has asked the approval of the French Parliament to enact this state of emergency for 3 more months, and it has been adopted by the Parliament last week. We understand that there's a great fear after the Paris attacks, but we think that these measures are, in reality, very dangerous.
And yet there is no outcry to speak of. Tell me how on board the electorate is with these measures.
Well, recent polls show that an extreme majority of the French population is in favor of these measures.
When all of the arrests took place, my first thought was, wow, the French police and security forces are very good at what they do. Is there any evidence that this was a mere roundup?
Well, this state of emergency means that under the pretext of these attacks, police officers without any control of judges have been able to proceed to arrests, to house searches, to assign people to their residence. And we don't know, of course, if there is any evidence against these people. And of course, there is a tremendous risk that the Muslim population in France will be exclusively targeted by these measures.
Have there been polls of the Muslim community in France, especially the suburbs of Paris, to get its sense of these new measures?
No, there haven't been. What we have is media trying to cover the consequences of these measures, and we have a clear sense now that the Muslim community is feeling as being targeted. And of course, this is a vicious circle, and it will create the grounds for future radicalization. And we fear very much that this fear will lead to more security measures being adopted. This will, in turn, create more fractures among the French society.
After 9/11, when the United States was in the very same sort of knee-jerk reaction to terrorist violence, the French government cautioned us about overreaction. The government seems to have thrown caution to the wind.
Yeah, totally. We lose our sense of reflecting upon past errors, and I think we need now, and what we would have needed from the French government, is this time for serenity and leaving us the time to reflect about the causes, because the causes of what had happened are very complex. I think they find their roots in, of course, social, economical problems that we have in France, major problems with French minorities that do not sufficiently identify to what is France. So I think we need to reflect upon this, preventing ourselves from reacting upon fear. And this is what is going on today. And the only thing that is proposed to French citizens is restriction on our liberties and more security. And I think that compared to the January attacks, what is interesting now is that a debate is taking place to question if religion was the main factor of their radicalization. The profile of the terrorists that have been identified so far shows more a reject of our society for social reasons, for economical reasons, than religious radicalization.
After 9/11, it was very easy for Congress to pass the Patriot Act with the prodding of the Bush administration. But the legislators at least had the foresight to know that in time cooler heads would prevail and put a sunset provision in the law so that it was significantly re-legislated, what is now called the Freedom Act. Has the French Parliament done the same? Did these measures, giving so much surveillance opportunities to the state, expire in time?
No, the legislation that was passed in May 2015 gives permanent powers to the administration. These are definite laws that will not be revised unless, of course, there is a change in political will to do so. But there is no limited period for these pieces of legislation.
Clémence, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Clémence Bechtard is a Paris-based lawyer for the International Federation for Human Rights.
Coming up, why the Patriot Act doesn't matter.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 6 months ago, one of the most outspoken critics of the Patriot Act from the right was Libertarian Senator Rand Paul. Here he is last May during his 10.5-hour filibuster of the expiring provisions.
There comes a time in the history of nations when fear and complacency allow power to accumulate and liberty and privacy to suffer. That time is now, and I will not let the Patriot Act, the most unpatriotic of acts, go unchallenged.
6 months later, and in the midst of his presidential campaign, Paul hasn't changed his tune. Here he is speaking on CBS last week.
Already many in the intelligence community are saying, oh, if we only had the bulk phone collection program back. Well, what they're not telling you and what they're being dishonest about is we still have the phone collection program. In the United States, all phone records are still being collected all the time.
But Senator Paul doesn't merely condemn the Patriot Act. As he said in his filibuster, he wants to stop all surveillance, including the programs no one knows about.
So we know about this one, but what other programs are out there? There's something called Executive Order 12333. There are some who believe that this is just the tip of the iceberg, the bulk collection, that there's an enormous amount of data being collected on people through this other program.
Now, Rand Paul has been known to throw his lot in with, let's say, the conspiracy inclined. This is a man who vowed to look into whether the federal government was planning to invade Texas. And in 2011, he compared the right to health care to slavery. But in this case, he's got a point. Consider Executive Order 12333.
12333 is not a law. It's not a statute. It was never passed by Congress.
John Napier Tai is a former State Department official turned whistleblower. Here he is during a TED Talk last year, shedding some light on the mysterious executive order.
Most members of Congress have no idea that how this is being used at all. The NSA is using this authority to collect the majority of intelligence, but it actually got no press at all for a year after the Snowden leaks. A huge amount of data is being collected under 12333.
In fact, according to documents leaked by Edward Snowden, more than half of the metadata the NSA has collected comes not from the Patriot Act, but through 12333. So what is it? Here's what we know. 12333 was signed by President Reagan in 1981 to lay out rules for the intelligence community, including the surveillance of non-U.S. citizens on foreign soil. But that was before the internet, which is to say, before our communications were routinely bounced across the globe. Steve Vladek is co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog and a professor at the American University Washington College of Law. He says that the whole foreign-domestic divide is continually, inevitably breached.
The problem that has arisen is that although it's primarily aimed at surveillance of non-citizens outside the U.S., it seems increasingly clear that the government is collecting an awful lot of U.S. person communications as well, perhaps not intentionally, but certainly knowingly.
Well, does that have partly to do with the fact that the information that we send out digitally goes all over the world in packets? I could be sending something down the street, but it might make a stop in Bulgaria before it gets there.
Indeed. I mean, I think there are two reasons why this is happening. One is the fact that data is, in effect, borderless. We don't control where the data is going. But second, I think, is about the technological capabilities of our surveillance agencies. It just isn't possible, based on what we know right now, for those agencies to segregate communications from a U.S. person from communications from a non-U.S. person, at least at the moment of collection. They can't know who's the sender and who's the receiver when they just intercept a packet. They won't know until they actually look at more information about that specific communication.
Well, what kind of information are we talking about here? Phone metadata, you know, telephone numbers and durations of calls and so on? Or are we actually talking about content?
We don't actually know the whole story here because so much of the government's activities under 12333 remain classified. But there seems to be no question that some of what they're collecting under 12333 are the contents of emails, telephone calls, web searches. We just don't know where the lines are or what the rules are for when certain content is and is not collected.
And Congress doesn't know either.
Senator Feinstein, who was chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has said publicly, we really don't pay nearly as much attention to what the government does under 12333 as Congress does to what the government's doing under statutes Congress has passed, if for no other reason than Congress, I think, have long assumed that most of the 12333-based surveillance is directed overseas. And so that's why I think there are all these concerns about these authorities blurring together and all this focus on 215 perhaps distracting us from the larger puzzle, of which 215 is really a very, very small, almost infinitesimal piece.
There are a couple of other programs that achieved their 15 minutes of fame right after the Snowden leaks, one called PRISM and the other called Upstream. PRISM collected information from technology companies. Upstream collected communications literally upstream from the users as data moves through the infrastructure, like cables and so on. Neither of those programs are in the Patriot Act. They both come from Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So regardless of what happens with the Patriot Act, these two programs are going to continue, right?
At least for the time being. And so here I think it's worth trying to situate these programs within the larger story. So 12333 is directed at non-citizens outside the U.S. 215 is, and the Patriot Act is directed at citizens within the U.S. The gap is for non-citizens outside the U.S. who communicate through U.S. servers, whose emails, you know, go through a Google server in California or a Microsoft server in Massachusetts.
Taking my Bulgarian example again, it's not me sending information that might end up momentarily in Bulgaria and then get ensnared by 12333. It's somebody in Bulgaria whose material ends up in a server in California, say.
So that's what the statute's directed at. The problem is how does the government know which email is from the Bulgarian and which email is from you? And so the statute's directed at the problem of non-citizens overseas whose communications are routed through the U.S. The whole idea is that the government can go to Google, to Microsoft, to all these other internet service providers and basically ask them directly for that content. But once again, we run into the technological problem, which is how does the government segregate that information so that it's not also collecting your email that just happens to bounce through the same server in the same packet as the email from the Bulgarian to his friend in, say, the Czech Republic.
Won't they just dump my stuff when they get it because they're not authorized to have it?
So the government is supposed to, as you put it, dump that stuff so long as it's not relevant. And that's the whole purpose of these so-called minimization procedures.
I don't know what those are.
Well, no one does. So the minimization procedures are statutorily required rules fashioned by the government and administered by the FISA court that's basically supposed to govern not the collection of information, but what the government does once it's collected it. The problem is that one of the things we've learned since the Snowden disclosures came out is that the government has repeatedly violated the minimization rules that it has promulgated, that the FISA court has administered.
And how do we know that?
Because we've had these FISA court opinions that were previously classified, that were some combination of leaked and declassified by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, including an especially telling October 2011 opinion by John Bates, who was then the presiding judge of the FISA court, where he basically excoriates the government for a series of, in his view, completely intentional and perhaps even flagrant violations. So, you know, the regime is supposed to work on the theory that, yes, the government's going to accidentally collect some of our emails too, but they're never going to do anything with them. And yet everything we've learned over the last couple of years suggests that we shouldn't trust that that's how it's actually working on the ground.
So if the entire Patriot Act were to go up in a puff of smoke, would that diminish the kind of surveillance overreach that is currently underway, or would it simply happen through other means?
I think the government would just find ways to cleverly shoehorn existing programs into new authorities. I think the real lesson for all of us has to be, how do we bolster not just the substantive authorities the government has, but the ability of other institutions to check those authorities? As much as we might trust the government, as much as we might support this president or that president, at the end of the day, it's not going to be the executive branch that checks itself. And I think it's a very real possibility that come whatever happens, you know, with the surveillance reform bill, people are going to think that that's the end of the story. Not only is it not the end of the story, it is barely the beginning of the story.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Vladeck is professor of law at the American University in Washington College of Law and co-editor-in-chief of the Just Security blog. And now Andy of Mayberry gives Opie a lesson on civil liberties.
Opie, I can't listen to this. Now, I told you about eavesdropping.
But Paul, this is different.
Yes, it's worse. You overheard a conversation that was supposed to be private. Now, I can't be a party to that.
But Paul, if you just listen to this...
Opie, I can't listen.
Paul, you're erasing the tape.
That's what I mean to do. You bugged a conversation between a lawyer and his client. Now, that's violating one of the most sacred rights of privacy.
But Paul...
No buts.
But if it helps the law...
Opie, the law can't use this kind of help. Because whether a man is guilty or innocent, we have to find that out by due process of law.
When we embarked upon this show, we began with the assumption that in the terrifying wake of 9/11, if our elected officials had just been able to read the bill, then maybe we could have avoided all of this.
The Bush administration's roundup of Muslim immigrants, of course.
He leaked highly classified secrets. Now Edward Snowden, the man at the center of this major scandal, has been formally charged with espionage.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, is suing the government, claiming the mass surveillance of Americans is unconstitutional.
President Bush has defended the CIA and insisted that it does not torture terrorist suspects.
But maybe reading it wouldn't have mattered anyway.
People make a great fanfare out of reading the bill.
Congressman Bobby Scott.
The bill itself is a bunch of cross-references and words out of context that reading the bill, you really don't get a good understanding. So, I mean, the fanfare and who, quote, read the bill is more fanfare than substance.
In fact, the more people we spoke to, the clearer it became that despite the hasty, even sneaky passage of the initial bill, not reading it wasn't really the issue. Here's Senator Ron Wyden.
If you read the Patriot Act, you scratch your head and say, where does it say here that the government can collect millions and millions of phone records on law-abiding Americans?
Even Jim Sensenbrenner, who penned one version of the bill and read all of them, was stunned by the revelations of recent years.
I was the chairman of this committee on September 11th.
and the author of the Patriot Act. I can say in no uncertain terms that Congress did not intend to allow the bulk collection of Americans' records. The government's overbroad collection is based on a blatant misreading of the law.
No, he says, this toxic situation was not caused by the failure to craft a good bill or the failure to read that bill. It is most of all
the failure of oversight by the two intelligence committees in Congress that instead of doing oversight to see if the law was being properly applied and make recommendations to improve the administration of the law, they ended up being cheerleaders for the intelligence community, and that's why we are facing a problem.
But we also began with another assumption, that somehow that story of overreaching surveillance, the widespread violation of civil liberties, the detentions, the noxious hum of bad news buzzing like a media mosquito in the background, that all that is somehow related to the Patriot Act.
Right. And that's a profound, profound misunderstanding.
Mort Halperin, a denizen of several White Houses, now with the Open Society Foundations, says that most of the big stories we associate with the Act were not found in nor justified by the Act.
Guantanamo, the CIA secret prisons, and these seizures of people, including American citizens, in the United States and putting them in the military prison, all of that was done under the president's claimed inherent authority under the Constitution as the Commander-in-Chief. They relied not at all on any word in the Patriot Act.
I find something very ironic here. For such a long time, I mean, you would certainly say that the Patriot Act was being used as something of a boogeyman. But now, if we are in fact living in the world of the Patriot Act, at least we're all in the same legislative arena.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We'd been much better off if the Bush administration had, you know, dealt with al-Qaeda using the Patriot Act.
But you did think it was a bad bill, a bad
law. Yeah, but
law.
I actually thought nowhere near as bad as most people did. But given that people had flown airplanes into the Twin Towers, I actually would have guessed beforehand that the bill that would pass would have been much worse than the Patriot Act. Now, what I didn't know is that what we were going to do was going to be much worse.
In looking to a brighter future with limited surveillance, legal detention, and stronger government oversight, Mort Halperin, devout civil libertarian, draws a surprising conclusion.
We're coming back now to, because the excesses of the Bush administration and the ways in which they relied on inherent authority are one by one being discredited, we're now living much more in the world of the Patriot Act and the Patriot Act as Congress passed it at the time than we ever have been before. I think we're finally in the right arena, which is these things have to be done in the Congress. They have to be done by passing statutes that mean what they say and that have their plain meaning and everybody understands and agrees what authority they're giving. And I think we're getting back there.
Wow. That's kind of a kick in the pants. A post-Patriot Act world has been the dream of countless lawyers, lawmakers, and activists since October 2001. But if you hung around this hour, then you've heard of all that's not in the Act, all that's essentially unregulated and unchecked. It turns out that now, if Congress adheres to and actually oversees the Patriot Act, it can make inroads into what's been some pretty wild executive territory. Now maybe Congress will be able to put up a fence or two where once the intelligence agencies ran free. That's better than nothing, says Halperin. And what's more, it's a delicious irony. Of all the unintended consequences of the Patriot Act, this certainly was the least likely.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman, who did most of the heavy lifting for this special episode. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina, Alex Friedland, and the ACLU. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter's WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.